The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm laughing there because I started speaking and then I had to look down to check that I had turned the volume button on. I have occasionally started the show with the volume button switched off and been speaking to myself for a few minutes before Mike starts to call down the line saying, "Where are you?" So listen, I hope you're well, and I hope you're not just hanging around, as the song says. We're hanging around waiting for Christmas to come. Now, today on the show, we have a real literary detective theme running through it. In the next segment, I'm joined by Catherine Weir, who is an expert on Dorothy L. Sayers. Dorothy L. Sayers, the author of the Lord Peter Wimsey detective series, very famous, 1920s, 1930s when it was written. She's the kind of slightly more literary version of Agatha Christie, but we'll go into that more when I'm speaking to her. And speaking of Agatha Christie, who also started writing at the same time as Dorothy L. Sayers in the early 20s, the story time today is all about the greatest selling novelist of all time, who is Agatha Christie. And I'm going to be speaking about a mysterious involvement she had with what became known as the Agatha Christie indult. That's right, the indult, something which is canon law related. Why did the best-selling author of all time sign a petition to retain the Latin Mass just over 50 years ago? Tune in to Storytime in the final segment and all will be revealed. Or will it? Well, you have to wait and find out about that. So I was thinking about Christmas today, and I know where we have decided, you and me, on this show that we would be Radio Advent throughout these weeks. There's far too much Christmas on radio, television, billboards, shopping malls, all the rest of it, when we know it's Advent, right? It's not Christmas yet. It's nowhere near. Last time I looked, it was the third week of Advent. We've got another week coming up. So I'm still trying to resist the urge to dive into the whole Christmassy thing, which is so prevalent in all Western societies, in the United States, the United Kingdom, wherever you happen to be. So I'm still resisting that urge. But the thing is that next week on the show, just to give you the heads up, we will start to enter into the spirit of Christmas properly when we start to preface some lots of good things that you can listen to, read, or watch during your Christmas vacation. So we'll be having people on talking about beautiful Christmas music, great Christmas films, great Christmas novels, short stories, that sort of thing. We've got all of that to look forward to. So don't worry, we have not turned into Radio Scrooge. We're just Radio Advent, and there is a big difference, and I'm sure I don't need to explain it to you. You will know what that is. I'm amazed at how many people Mike can get into the studio and laughing at the same time. It's just incredible.
I have a unique gift.
You have many gifts, Mike, including the gift of patience with radio hosts. If you're struggling with the anti-spirit of Christmas, the anti-Christmas that flees around the doors at this time of years, in shopping malls, in homes, in families, where people want to celebrate it, and you say, no, 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 you must wait, then I'd love to hear about your titanic battles with these individuals. Give me a call on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. I'd love to know about that. I'm going to tell you a little story in a minute about a very funny incident which happened in Scotland, which I think sums this up. But before I do, I want to remind you, as always, that at the top of the hour, we will be doing the Divine Mercy Chaplet. That is the most important moment of this show. It's 3 o'clock in London. It's the hour of great mercy. It's the hour when we will be asking for divine mercy to come into specific situations. And that might be a situation that you're dealing with. It might be a family problem. It might be a medical problem. It might be an emotional problem, work-related, whatever. We are happy to pray for you. And you can be part of that. You can call in during that 30 minutes of prayer and have your request aired on the radio, and we will definitely pray for you. And that's 888-928-0881. Or at any time during the show, or in fact, any time 24 hours a day, the text line is open on 251-928-2111. So if you're listening on the Encore presentation at night, or a playback, streaming, whatever, on the Archangel app, don't despair. You can be part of the prayer at any time. If you're going to be texting, I think if you're texting outside the United States, you need to put a 1 in front of that. So it's 1251-928-2111. We'd love to hear from you. Very glad to hear from you. For example, yesterday we prayed for Noah, who was in a very bad car crash somewhere out in Colorado. And we hope Noah's doing well. I was thinking about him last night as I was falling asleep. Poor man, this time of year. So many things like that seem to happen. Now, the other thing which I was going to suggest to you is that I have two cracking sort of Christmas ghost stories, true ones, that I would love to share with you, but I can't decide which one to choose. And I thought, well, next week, being at the run-up to Christmas, and, you know, we all love a good ghost story at Christmas, especially the Irish. We love them at any time of the year, but Christmas is a great excuse to have a Christmas ghost story. I have two possible ghost stories to tell you. One is the night I spent in a haunted house. Yes, a real haunted house. Or the night I met Count Dracula. Now, you may think I've just made that last one up. I haven't, and all will be revealed. But what I'm going to do is to put out a sort of competition. You choose which do you prefer to listen to. Just text in haunted house or text in Dracula, and we'll right. work out in the next few days.
I'm going to interject here, Kevin. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't know. I don't speak for the masses here, but at some point, if people choose the haunted house, fine. But you got to tell me how you met Count Dracula, and I'll hang up here.
So that is Mike voting. So we have one vote on the board for Count Dracula.
Yes.
No votes for the haunted house. What about
in the lead?
Yeah, exactly. But what about our new charge? Is he still here? Did he come back after day one?
Yes, he is. Reed, would you like to hear the haunted house story? Sorry, or would you like to hear the Count Dracula story?
The Count Dracula story sounds pretty interesting.
All right, so 2-0 right now.
We're
in the lead.
Well, Mike, before Reed, just as Reed there, I'd like to. Reed, are you
he's
there?
He's here.
Reed, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I know you were pressured into that vote by Mike, okay? You know, you're a newish member of staff, and he forced you to vote for Dracula. So if you want to, you can still text in for the haunted house story on 251-928-2111, okay? Just wanted to say that.
Okay.
But don't let Mike hear that, though, but we know, okay?
Okay.
So that's two votes, allegedly, for the vote rigging going on already. Two votes for the Count Dracula story, but the haunted house is a good one. The haunted house is a cracking tale. But you have to vote. You have to vote in. So do use your text, 251-928-2111. And if we don't get more than 10 votes, and this is where I'm really turning into Ebenezer Scrooge, if we don't get more than 10 votes, then neither story will ever be told. So the ball is in your court. Bounce, bounce, over to you. Now, the other thing which I don't know about you, but I mean, it's been a while since I worked in an office, a secular office, where there was always one person in the office who was Mr. or Miss Christmas. And you know the sort of person I'm talking about. They were not religious in the slightest. Often had no religion of any description. But they were the sort of office social events person. You know, they were always organizing things during the summer months. They'd be organizing things, and anyway, Christmas was their moment when they looked forward to it like nobody's business, right? And their enthusiasm was a way, oh, stop, we have had a text for the haunted house. Thank you, anonymous text come in. That means two to Dracula, allegedly, one to haunted house. So 2-1 at the moment. And no, sorry, Mike, it's 2-1. We're coming back. This could go to penalties, but we have to have 10 votes
come on,
before
listeners.
Anything will be decided.
Come on, listeners, count Dracula.
Mike is counting the votes, so he's not allowed to vote early and vote often. Okay, so in this office there was always Mr. and Miss Christmas, and they would be, you know, they'd be organizing the Christmas event in sort of November time, and I was always a little bit skeptical about these things, not because I've got anything against Christmas. I think as I got older, I got more and more disinterested in the whole social side of offices, obviously. But I was always a little bit cautious about Christmas because I had that scruple, if you like, which the people in the office who were not Catholic, not Christian, would not understand, which was that I didn't want to be celebrating Christmas in Advent. That was it. You know, there was no mystery to it. I was all for them to go out and celebrate our Lord's birth, if that's what they were doing, however obliquely in their minds they were doing it, fair enough. But I remember they would, at one point I was managing the office, and the manager in the office is always the person who sets the tone for these things. So I'd always have a sort of a committee would arrive. And they'd sit in front of me and say, Kevin, we want to have this Christmas doing it. And I'd say, brilliant. And they'd say, and we want this, and we want this. And I'd say, do it. I said, as long as I don't have to organize it, as long as I don't have to do anything, get on with it. Brilliant. So they'd be, okay, that's fine. And off they'd go. And but in the same way that this spirit was building, there was another questionnaire that used to go around the office a lot. And I used to really look forward to it around Christmas time. And it was a question which no Catholic should really spend too much time on. No Christian should. And that is, what is your star sign? You ever hear this? It would always come up in these sort of social events, or even not so social events. There would always be one person, a bit like Mr. and Mrs. Christmas, who would, sometimes it was Mr. and Mrs. Christmas, right? It was the same person. And they'd be trying to work out whose star sign is what, right? They'd always be asking your birthday and this sort of thing. And I'd be rather vague about that. And sometimes being the manager of an office, people are very curious about what star sign you're is because they've been reading some astrological star sign. And it says something like, you will fall out with the boss today, or the boss will tell you X, Y, or Z today. So they're always trying to work out my star sign. And I remember I was having a team meeting, one of those obligatory team meetings, which I had as few as I could have. And I was sitting there listening to gripes and groans and moans. And the Christmas thing came on, and everybody talking about Christmas. And they'd all be saying, are you coming to the Christmas party this year? And I'd say, no, I've got other commitments. And one of the great things about being boss was you could say that sort of thing and look into the distance and nobody would say, what commitments? My commitments were to go home, put my feet up, take out Matthew's gospel and read the first two chapters. So anyway, it got then talking about astrological signs, and it was a little bit of jollity, I guess, in this team meeting. And it was run up to Christmas, and they went round and everybody was saying, oh, I'm Sagittarius, or I'm Capricorn, or I'm Virgo, or I'm Leo, or whatever. Everybody seemed to know what sign they were, right? Some of them hardly knew what day it was, it seemed, on a Monday, but they all knew what star sign there was. So, and I could feel that this was coming round to me, right? You could just feel this wave coming round the room towards me. And I was sitting thinking, well, what shall I say? You know, because listen, we're going to star signs another day, but I don't want to encourage this, right? Belief in astrology is not compatible with Christian faith, okay? No matter what you've read, what you've heard, we do not believe that our destinies are created by newspaper editors who send the junior intern down to write the astrological columns. I kid you not. If you are the newest member in a newspaper, your job is to write the stars. I'm so glad I never got that job, because it would have been, today the world is ending. Maybe you should think about going to a nuclear fallout shelter. But anyway, they never let me loose on that sort of thing, which I'm rather relieved about. So it was coming round, right? The question was coming round. I could feel it. And everybody was, you know, we were now on to, oh, you're a Virgo. Yeah, but I'm a Virgo with the Capricorn rising. And we're getting into all that sort of nonsense, right? You know, that, and the moon is coming into this one and the Saturn and blah, blah, blah. They all seem to be experts, right? It's coming around the room. So I was the last person in the room, the only person who hadn't spoken, maybe about 20 people. And the person who's, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Christmas or Mr. and Mrs. Star Sign, they said, and Kevin, what's your star sign? Right? What's your star sign? Now, I didn't, now they all knew I was a Christian, but I didn't want to come across as somebody, I didn't want to lecture them as I just lectured you on why star signs and astrology are so incompatible with the Christian faith. So what did I do and what did I say? What would you say in that situation? Well, best thing I did, I just sat back, looked into the distance again, you know, the way I had done when I was talking about my commitments. And I said, me, I'm Star of Bethlehem. And they all, with Christmas coming, I said, I'm Star of Bethlehem. And they went completely quiet. And they didn't know what to make of it. And one of them said, no, Kevin, what are you really? Star of David. Star of David, Star of Bethlehem, what's this guy on? Anyway, I said, meeting's over, see you next week. Bang, and off we went. And anytime anybody ever quizzed me on my, excuse me, star sign, I would always say, Star of Bethlehem. So if anybody's listening at work and somebody says, hey, what's happening at Christmas? Let me just check my stars. You say, I don't have to. I've already checked my stars. They go, oh, really? You're a believer too? Yes, Star of Bethlehem. And you know what? Star of Bethlehem brings what? The wise men got great joy when they saw the star over Bethlehem. Okay? So this is a star sign which brings you joy, which brings you peace, which brings you understanding, but which also brings you to the right place this year. Which is a stable with a poor family, a husband and a wife and a newborn child lying in a manger because there's no room at the inn. And that is the true spirit of Christmas. And that is our guiding light through this Advent period. Now, I haven't had a chance to tell you my story about Scotland. That'll have to come tomorrow. Listen, we've had another, wait a minute, we're having lots of votes. We've had three votes in, all asking for the haunted house. So the haunted house is in the lead. Three to the haunted house, two what? To Dracula. Absolutely.
Come on, so Dracula listen, fans.
The voting lines are open. Keep voting. Vote early and vote often. Now, when we come back, we're talking Dorothy L. Sayers. You're not going to want to miss this. Stay with me. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here on Archangel Radio. Now, Dr. Catherine Ware is the managing editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture published by the Center for Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas. She is also a musician and a songwriter with a recent album, And All the Marys, about women in the Gospels, and has a YouTube channel which you can check out later. We'll give you the details for that in a moment. But the reason she's joining us today on the show is that she is a scholar, a renowned scholar, specialized in the religious drama of no less than Dorothy L. Sayers. And Catherine is the editor of the upcoming book, The Man Born to be King, Weird Annotated Edition, which is due out next month by IVP Academic Press. Catherine, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Listen, it's a great joy to meet you because I thought I was the only person in the world who was a fan of The Man Born to be King.
That's great. It's actually a very well-loved set of plays, and I'm so glad that they're coming back in print with this edition.
But, before we get to that, and I do want to talk to you specifically about that, let's paint the scene a little bit, because some people listening, believe it or not, Catherine, won't know who Dorothy L. Sayers is. Who is she, and who was she, and what was she?
So Dorothy L. Sayers, what I love about her is that she was a writer of all kinds of different genres. So she started out as a poet, then she moved into murder mysteries. So that's actually what she's probably best known for in a popular sense. And then she moved into writing essays and religious plays, which is where these plays come in. And then at the end of her life, she actually spent many years focusing on the Divine Comedy by Dante and doing one of the first really like important translations from Italian into English, and that's one of the reasons why English speakers know Dante very well, because of her work.
Yes, and I think that's a very good summation of her literary path. The woman herself remains a little bit of an enigma in some ways, but we'll come back to that in a second. I mean, you're right. If you stop the average person on the street today, Agatha Christie, everybody knows. Still,
yes.
Mainly because of television adaptations and films and stuff. Mm-hmm. Dorothy L. Sayers, although they both started writing their crime fiction almost at the same time.
Right.
Dorothy L. Sayers is for the cognoscenti, if you know what I mean, Catherine. it's the acquire, you know, because let's be honest. Well, let me ask you, right? How would you compare and contrast the writing styles of Christie and Sayers?
Oh, interesting. Well, I think every mystery writer has their own kind of formula, right? So G.K. Chesterton has, his Father Brown, who, you know, really gets at the heart of sort of the moral, what's happening in the person. But Father Brown always can see himself. He solves the crime because he can picture himself as the sinner. You know, he knows
Correct.
That he has the
Yeah.
capacity to commit murder, just like whoever is the murderer in the book. Christie has, you know, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple, who, you know, bring together all the details and then bring everybody together at the end. And that's sort of her style, you know, the revelation at the end with all the suspects together. Sayers has this wonderful aristocratic character called Lord Peter Wimsey, who his sort of way of solving it is, you know, he has all these he pulls together all the details, but it's not a public display at the end. Often he actually has a sort of gentleman to gentleman discussion with them. And in a few books, he actually gives them the gentleman's way out,
That's right.
You know, that kind of a thing. So it's a different style. But Sayers also, especially toward the end of her mystery series, it's really her novels are really developing into a kind of mystery of manners, and she becomes more interested in them as characters and really develops them as characters, both Peter Wimsey and so, you know, he becomes a real person by the end. And so I think that's what I sort of love about her books. You really see a development through the, you know, 15 years or so that she was writing detective fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, everything you've said, Catherine. I mean, you're putting it very nicely and in a very academic sense. If I could put it through, put the journalistic dagger into the heart of this, I would say that Dorothy L. Sayers was a first-class writer. Agatha Christie was a first-class puzzle maker. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do.
Because the other thing is that I think as time went on, Dorothy fell in love with Lord Peter Wimsey, or it was certainly that kind of, she loved Lord Peter Wimsey. Whereas we all know that Agatha Christie grew to despise Hercule Poirot by the end, which sort of comes across a little bit in that but the thing about Sayers is that her novels are very much of the time, the 1920s, 1930s, very, very London set. Whereas Agatha Christie's are cardboard cutouts that could be set anywhere and are often set anywhere in places that don't exist or wherever. And the reason I ask that is because I'm wondering, would you suggest, given your interest, if there's a bit of a Sayers revival or reassessment taking place today?
I hope so. I think the especially her mystery novels are due for a redo on the BBC and what we and the public television here. There is a series of older ones, from the 80s and early 90s, but it would be great to see a revival of that in a popular sense. I'm just thinking of an example, for instance, in Gaudy Night, which is her novel that's set in Oxford at a women's college. There's a lot of, it was written in 1935, and there's a lot of, you can get a sense of really what's happening in Europe at the time. So, for instance, there's a character who is the porter at the lodge, at the gate of the women's college, who suggests that maybe we need a little bit more Hitler. We need a little more Hitler to kind of keep society in line. So she's very aware of what's happening, and that those things of the time find their way into the book, in her books, which I think are kind of fascinating. So even a revival that brings those things out would be really interesting.
Yeah, I think, I'm pondering, we've just had a question actually, it's just come in saying, why did Agatha Christie become more popular than Dorothy L. Sayers? What would you say to that, Catherine?
Part of it is that Agatha Christie, I think, wrote many, many more novels.
Yes, absolutely. She never stopped.
She never stopped.
She also lived a good 20 years longer than Dorothy, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's part of it. Of course, she herself disappeared and had, so she was in the news for a whole mystery of her own in her personal life. Agatha Christie, that is. But I think Sayers, because she was interested in lots of different kinds of genres, she herself talks about in letters how she's sort of growing tired of the, that format, and that she felt like people were getting too, kind of satisfied with this book that just wraps up everything by the end, and that life really isn't like that. So by the time we get to World War II, she feels like that's not what the British public needs. They need, kind of hard truths, or just, real truths that get to the center of what is happening in the world right now. How can we address what's happening? What kind of world do we want to build after the war? So her focus really turns elsewhere. Although she did, I think, that during the war, she serialized a few things that were in the papers that continued stories of the Wimsey family and what they were doing during the war, which is interesting.
I think maybe that in some ways what you're saying, Catherine, or just as you're talking there, I'm thinking that's why Christie remains so popular, whether it's UK or US. It's because all of life's problems get sorted out by the end of the book. There's no loose ends. Mm-hmm. There's always a denouement and everything is. But anyway, moving away from what she's known for, maybe unfairly just known for in the mind of many today. I mean, Dorothy L. Sayers was a very considered thinker, especially in terms of theology. She was an Anglican all her life, a very devout Anglican. And this shaped her worldview and also her sort of life's dramas as they played out.
Yes. There was definitely a big theme in her life. So her father was an Anglican clergyman. Mm-hmm. And when she was at Oxford University, she started... I mean, her father was sort of a broad church, kind of Anglican. She kind of moved toward Anglo-Catholic circles, so she got more interested. She talks about, for instance, going to confession, which is, would be more of an Anglo-Catholic kind of expression, and that kind of thing. But she sometimes, there are a few times where people thought that she was going to become Catholic, like G.K. Chesterton. In fact, the British press sort of suggested that at one point, and she was actually quite angry at that response about hoping to see Miss Sayers follow GKC into the arms of Mother Church, which she didn't really appreciate. But I think at the time, culturally, I really can't see her, for instance, of making that choice to become Catholic with everything else that was going on. But what she was really focused on, particularly in the late 30s and coming up to, you know, the war, this is the same time period we've been talking about, she was really interested in what do all Christians share, or what is, sure, what is kind of the center of faith. And that's when she really focused her work on the creeds. She did a whole series of talks for the BBC on the Nicene Creed called Christ in the Creeds. And there's a published collection of those. I really recommend those to people. So she takes it, you know, phrase by phrase, really focuses on that. And she talks about what she calls the combined Catholic front, which by which she means Anglicans, Roman Catholics, and Eastern Orthodox, that what are the things that we have in common in terms of what we would call patrimony, you know, the creeds, mm-hmm, the councils, having, you know, hierarchies like, you know, bishops and priests and the orders that were really all the way from the beginning of the church. What do we have in common? And from being able to speak to a world that was losing touch, I mean, she was saying even more so now, you know, losing touch with what is even the Christian message. And if she could gather those people, some projects, for instance, there was one that was called, she called the Ecumenical Penguin, that never got published. But it was an idea that this kind of combined Catholic front could share, this is what the Christian message is, together. Yeah. She's very passionate about that.
You're listening to Dr. Catherine Ware, who is the managing editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture, but she's also the editor of the forthcoming book, The Man Born to be King, the Wade Annotated Edition, which is published next month. You're absolutely right, Catherine. I mean, you're making me think that she's part of that kind of principally English literary movement, people like T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, and Dorothy L. Sayers, who remained very much Anglican, and Agatha Christie as well, actually, funny enough. They all were high Anglicans by the end, and some of them were drifting probably towards Rome, as in C.S. Lewis's case, towards the end of his life. But they all saw themselves very much as part of the Catholic, in the sense of the broad Orthodox doctrines of the church, which Orthodox, Anglican, and Catholic at the time could certainly. So it was a strange kind of sort of literary ecumenism that she was part of. Is that a fair summation?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. She also gets fan letters, and people say, oh, you must be Methodist. You know,
why did they say that?
For instance. She would get people assuming that she was Catholic, people assuming she was Anglican. And I was just thinking of one instance where someone said, oh, you must be Methodist because that's what I am. And I recognize my own faith and what you're writing about. And she said, oh, well, I'm not Methodist, but I'm honored that you think so, because that shows that I'm really focusing on the core of the Christian message.
Yeah. Now, I hope you can stay for the second segment, Catherine.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to focus more on the man to be born to be king, because I think it comes at a fascinating period. But you probably know, I mean, the BBC then was producing some amazing stuff. I mean, because it had, for example, G.K. Chesterton before his death in 36 was becoming a real star on the BBC radio. But around about the same time as the man to be born to be king, we had C.S. Lewis. doing the Screwtape Letters. So it's this fascinating moment when Popular Broadcasting, the biggest media outlet in the world, was promoting Christianity in very interesting ways. So when we come back, we will be discussing The Man Born to be King, and you are not going to want to miss this. And if you haven't listened to The Man Born to be King, you will after this. Back after these words.
Kind of sounds like that 1940s, you know, crime detective song, doesn't it, Kevin? She walked into the room and I couldn't help but notice the beautiful eyes, beautiful hands. Anyway.
Well, talking of beautiful eyes and beautiful hands, we are joined by Dr. Catherine Weir, who is the managing editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture. She's also a living expert on the writings of Dorothy L. Sayers. I hope you liked the music, Catherine. It was specially chosen to create that sort of noirish atmosphere.
It really did. Love it.
Because the thing about Dorothy L. Sayers, and we will come to Man Born to be King, but there's a dark side to her as well. Her life was far from the kind of breeziness that you get in her writings.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I think, as I was saying, her writing really developed, but I think her faith and kind of understanding of herself really developed over her life too. Like, hopefully it does. It does for all of us. So I think in her 20s, there was a little more sort of exploring, less interest in faith, less activity. It's at that time when she had an illegitimate son, who she didn't even tell her friends about until she died. and although she did stay connected to him her whole life. But she married a man who had been divorced, and so that late in the late 20s, early 30s, there was a lot of, I think, kind of marital angst between them. But after that point, when she really decides, no, this is the life that God gave me, I'm going to live into it and make the most of it. You really see kind of a maturity in her writing. At that point, her characters, I think, become more human at that point. But she also, there's a real growing interest in faith and writing about faith subjects that we see throughout the 30s and into the 40s there.
And that's the point at which The Man Born to be King enters the scene. Now, I came across this radio drama many years ago, listening on the BBC. And immediately I thought it was a great piece of work. I mean, it was one of the modern adaptations, I forget, maybe from the 70s, being replayed or whatever. But when I was preparing for this today, I was wondering why Dorothy L. Sayers had chosen, first of all, radio drama, and why this?
Yes, well, I mean, this is part of the interesting story. As you say, the BBC was doing a lot of religious work, and they actually commissioned these plays. So she had been asked to do that series on the creeds that I mentioned, they knew her, worked with her. She was asked to do just a one-hour nativity play in 1938 called He That Should Come, and that was just so successful that they... the head of religious broadcasting, Dr. James Welch, came back to her and said, we'd actually love for you to do an entire series on the whole life of Christ. Would you be interested? And she came back saying, I would. Here are sort of the conditions, which I think are interesting that she, from the very beginning of the project, she had that in mind. She really wanted Jesus to be an actual character, which sounds very normal to us, but had not been done because it was seen as perhaps it would be irreverent, worrying about a person actually portraying Christ. This is something that had not been even legal to do since the time of the Reformation until, maybe 1914, 15, somewhere in there that actually the law changed. But people still needed permission from the government to put on a play in which Jesus was a character. So for her to say, Jesus has to be a character in this was something that was a big deal. And they actually got permission from the Lord Chamberlain in the government in order for this set of plays to happen. So she wanted Jesus to be a character. She wanted people to speak everyday English. So she didn't just want to take dialogue directly from the King James. She wanted to make it seem, help people know these were regular people that had lived regular lives, that encountered a real Jesus who really lived and really grew up in a family, really did all these things. He wasn't just sort of a spirit that appeared and then went away. No, he was a real human being. She wanted to portray that. And she also used British accents from different areas around the UK, or mostly England, but different class accents, different regional accents, in order to get that, that feeling that this was Jesus coming to regular people, not just in a book, but in real flesh and blood.
You're listening to Dr. Catherine Weir, who's with me this morning talking about Dorothy L. Sayers, and in particular, Dorothy's wonderful work, The Man Born to be King, which was a 12-part radio drama broadcast originally in the 1940s on the BBC, but now freely available through the wonders of technology, no doubt, on YouTube and other places. You're hinting there, Catherine, at something which is really, I think today it's rather blasé that somebody portrays our Lord, be it on camera or on radio, whatever. But this was quite revolutionary to the BBC in the 1940s. Dorothy was in sort of avant-garde of radio drama, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To insist that, the only portrayal of Christ in a dramatic form on the BBC had been during a series on the life of St. Paul called Paul of Tarsus, where it was just that scene where Christ appears to him on the road. That was like the only occasion where that had happened before, where someone portrayed Christ in a dramatic form on the BBC before. And that was taking words directly from the Bible too. So this is a whole different thing that she's doing.
Absolutely.
And it was very controversial, but also once people actually heard them, they loved them.
Right. And what we also don't realize today is that radio was the medium of the 1940s, the 1930s, and the 1940s. Right. People, certainly in Britain and certainly in the United States, had a radio set of some sort. And that's what they listened to for drama as much as for news and all the rest of it. There was no television as such. Cinema was there, but radio had a greater reach. So these plays would have had a huge audience in their time. And they were also being broadcast at a very interesting time. Talk to me a bit about the reaction to them, not so much from the chattering classes, but the fact that this was broadcast in December 1941, when Britain was very much on the back foot in the Second World War, must have had an impact on the audience.
Yes. Yeah. So you think just after, for Americans, this is just after Pearl Harbor. So America is just entering the war, but Britain had been at war for 2 years by this point. And are just over 2 years. And so, a real sense of that. That's part of the controversy. People who were very conservative and against these, they felt like, this might incur the wrath of God for something that they considered irreverent to be promoted on the BBC. And they wrote lots of letters to the BBC. So,
I think I came across, Catherine, I came across it. Somebody suggested that Singapore had fallen because The Man Born to be King was broadcast.
Yes.
It's just ridiculous.
That kind of letter happened, for sure.
But tell me this. I mean, Dorothy, I mean, she wrote a number of radio dramatizations. You alluded to the earlier one, He That Should Come. Remind me, when was that broadcast? What year?
That was, I thought it was, maybe it was Christmas 1938.
Right. So, I mean, was Dorothy, in your researches, was she a great fan of the radio as a dramatic art, or was she just aware that it was the medium that she needed to access to get a wider cultural message out?
I think both. I mean, she certainly listened to the radio just as everyone else. He That Should Come, even before that, she had adapted some of her own mysteries for radio as well. So she had done that kind of dramatic writing for radio. And then of course the addresses, The Christ and the Creed, and then a few other one-offs. But the Christ and the Creeds series, I should say, was so successful, but she was the first lay person to be asked to speak on a religious topic. Before that, it was all clergymen. But on the success of that, that's why C.S. Lewis was invited to do his series, which became Mere Christianity. So she was the trailblazer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Man Born to Be King was broadcast in 1942, but I don't think, or 41, 42, but I don't think the original episodes are in existence. Is that correct? The original broadcasts? A bit like the Screwtape Letters, they don't exist either.
Well, actually, the original broadcasts do exist. You can, there's only a couple, you have to actually go to either the British Library, the BBC Archives in Reading, or to the Wade Center at Wheaton College, and you can hear the originals. But the 1967 edition, which is probably the one that you might have heard before, that one was just re-released on Audible. So you can get that through Audible or through Amazon and hear all 12 of the plays in the most recent radio production.
Why is there a reason why the original version is not sort of widely disseminated or available for scholars to listen to?
Well, it is, as I say, you know, available for scholars in those, places. But having listened to it myself, I will say that I think later ones are better. They were recorded live, and so you can hear all the actors speeding up toward the end because they're like, "Ooh, our time limit is coming," and things were cut. I think there's also less of a differentiation between some of the voices. You know, there's lots of disciples, and so some of them sound similar, so there are a few scenes where you think, I can't tell who's speaking. Is that Andrew again, or is that Peter, or is that Matthew? And so that kind of a thing they did two more productions, and because they redid them in the late 40s, and then this 1967 World Service recording, and so when they redid them, you know, they didn't do it live. They did it in a more relaxed way so that they could, make some different production choices and stuff. But I mean, they're interesting to listen to to hear that. They're also, you know, it's a very crackly kind of old recording, which is fun to listen to. I quite like the 1967 ones, which are available now. So
Would that be your personal favorite, do you think, Catherine, or the place you would recommend? The Raymond Reichs, I think it is, isn't it, who directed that?
I don't know that name off the top of my head. But I think they're great fun. So you can find those now, and that could be a companion to reading the Wade annotated edition, too. And you can actually see, if you follow along with the scripts, you can see where they make little cuts in order to make the scenes shorter to fit their own time frame.
So talk to me about the annotated edition, Catherine. I mean, it's obviously the script, and so, but it's setting it in context and giving it a sort of three-dimensional feel, I guess, and understanding how it came about.
Right, exactly. So the idea came to me to do an annotated edition because I was reading the plays and I kept saying to myself, now, which gospel is this story from? Or, you know, what details are from, you know, I even as a biblical, you know, student through my different degrees. I had a lot of tools, but I thought, oh, what would be really great is if there was an edition where you could, there would be footnotes where you could see where the different scriptures are. So that's a big feature of this edition, tracking all the scripture. But then what I've also done is, so those are footnotes, and then there's side notes in this new edition that have excerpts from her letters or from her secondary sources. She used different commentaries or other biblical adaptations. And so where I, you know, think there's some connections there, and that's interesting to read. So you're kind of reading in context of what she's thinking, different choices. Because sometimes, especially I think some of the more interesting letter excerpts are when people wrote to her and said, what were you thinking? Mary Magdalene and Mary Bethany aren't the same person, because she made them a composite character. So it's nice to then see her response and say, well, I know that biblical scholars are starting to think that they weren't the same person, but the church has often thought that they were the same. Look at Augustine, and I'm happy to be in the same camp as St. Augustine, and that kind of thing. So it's like, you know that she's making choices knowingly. It's not that she's just, oh, oops, I didn't realize that. So that kind of thing is fun to get the little background.
Absolutely. No, it sounds absolutely fascinating. Where can people find out more, Catherine, about you and about this new edition that's due out?
Sure. So the IVP Academic website has a whole page for it. You can pre-order the book now. And then I have a website. It's just catherineware.com that talks more about the project, my work. You can see a listing of some of my other writings about Dorothy L. Sayers. I have videos about Sayers that are on my website too, and there are links there to my music and my YouTube page that has stuff about Sayers, and then some other projects as well.
Catherine, I took a look at it earlier, and I have to say it was a fascinating website, and it really whetted my appetite for all things Dorothy L. Sayers. She's a much more interesting character than initially I thought, and that's down to you, I think.
Aw. Well, thanks. I mean, she's a really interesting woman, and so she's, you know, when you study someone, you kind of feel like they become a friend, and so I do find myself sometimes thinking, I wonder what Dorothy would think of that. And that's fun to have the sort of companion along the way.
You've been listening to Dr. Catherine Ware talking about Dorothy L. Sayers. Do check out her website. It's fascinating. Catherine, thank you very much for coming on. I do hope you'll come back and speak more about the classic literary detective era. When we come back, we're going to be speaking about something else which is classic, which is the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And you can be part of that by calling in on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. It's a mystery, God's divine mercy, but the mystery can be solved through us applying it into our lives. So no intention is too small or too large. We are very happy to pray for that. So that is coming up straight after these words. And don't forget, the story time today is a special detective theme as well. We will be discussing Agatha Christie and her mysterious involvement with the what became known as the Agatha Christie Indult in regard to the Latin Mass, which the then Pope Paul VI signed back in the early 70s. You'll hear all about that during story time. We'll be back straight after these words.